out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system at radioarian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Friday, the 16th of March, 2018. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. As it's Friday, we are joined by Florian Geyer from Mysterium Fasces. Once again, Florian, how are you doing today?
Oh, not so bad myself, Sven. It's a pleasure to be back on the show, as always.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you here, and I'm also looking forward to hearing a new Mysterium Fasces on Monday.
That's
which
right.
listeners can look forward to that on Southern Nationalism. And today we're going to talk about one of our old favourites. We're going to talk about paganism once again, and the reason for that is I've had a couple of incidents with pagans recently, and I believe Florian has as well. And you know, I've got a few points that I think we should make about why Christianity is superior to paganism and why our ancestors put away their paganism. I've got a list of reasons here. I'm not sure which one we should start with. But one of the things I believe you wanted to talk about, Florian, was utilitarianism and people thinking that paganism is far more use to us. And you don't have to obey all these laws. Is that correct? Because I was thinking, well, that comes from a mortal viewpoint. Whereas with Christianity, you get the eternal viewpoint. This is why we shouldn't be breaking the laws of the Bible. We break the laws of the Bible and we say, okay, we can allow people to get divorced. Okay, we can allow gay marriage. What's the problem with that? Well, the Bible says there's going to be a problem with it. And of course, there wasn't really a problem with allowing divorce for a few generations. But now we've got masses of divorce, masses of kids with not being brought up by both parents. And of course, now we've got this gay marriage that has come about from this dissolution of all these laws. So we can't see that far into the future to know what the effects of breaking these laws are going to be. But the fact is, we have a Bible there and we have a God who is eternal. And the proof is that he is eternal because of what's written in that Bible and it coming true. And that tells us that we shouldn't be doing these things. So it's no good saying, well, this is far more pragmatic to do this. It's far more of use to us to do this. Because in the long run, these things won't be of use to us if they are breaking God's law. God's law is divine law, and divine law is based on natural law. And I thought I should make that point first.
I think that's absolutely correct. And I guess I was inspired to pick this topic at the request of a certain viewer of mine. So shout out to John if you're listening. And he asked me to basically discuss the fallacy of utilitarian morality. And it was not so much aimed at pagans, although they certainly fall under this category, but it was aimed a lot more at kind of Jordan Peterson types or kind of racist liberals, where people, they've come to see that religion is a necessary force for social organization. It provides a heritage, a bonding, a logos. And that without it, our civilization has fallen apart. But they don't. But for them, they see religion purely through a utility lens. That it's good because it produces, empirically measurable, beneficial social results. It increases social capital. And so, as you say, Sven, their perspective is totally mortal. It's totally worldly. And so, there's a couple of different issues that it comes down to. So, my friend ultimately was asking me to talk about why there's a need for true faith. Well, so I wrote a paper on the subject, and the thesis of the paper was that the central fundamental issue with the idea of utilitarian ethics is that it destroys itself. Because the whole reason that you have a transcendental system of belief or a religion. The reason why that's important for our behavior is because there's an anchor for our ethical demand that's not rooted in passable worldly conditions. There's an ethical imperative, right? So this is something that atheists and agnostics can never have, even if they believe in a certain code of ethics. There's never a imperative. There's never a reason they must do these certain things, which is what we're talking about when we're discussing, you know, human behavior and nationalism, creating a healthy society, healthy families. It's really about our own personal behavior, what we do in our lives. And so the problem is that if you believe in a non-eternal religion, a non-eternal truth, then you lose this imperative. The very faculty which enables men to commit great acts of heroism, to, you know, go into battle with no regard for themselves or for their welfare, to, you know, suffer and toil for years and years with no prospect of reward, only laboring for the greater good, to put aside their own, you know, selfish desires for the benefit of the group, even when the fruit of that benefit is not immediately obvious to them, or bears fruit later, you know, hundreds, even thousands of years after they sow the seeds. These are all contingent upon faith, because you're never going to, the whole motivating factor behind these actions is faith in their ethics, in their worldview, in what they're fighting for, the faith, family, folk. And these are the things which, are transcendent enough that every man can tap into and which motivates him towards these acts of heroism. So, and these things could only be true, these grand motivations can only be true if they're placed outside of time, if they're subject to the kind of relativism, the human molding, the rationalization that comes from a system of ethics which is situational. Not to say that they don't have to be applied situationally, but the principles are absolute. means that they might as well not exist. And so I think that this is kind of the core point that I wanted to make, was that people who see the good things of religion, well, they should know that these things are not separable from the faith, the underlying authenticity and genuineness of the belief in the God of the Bible and the church that these things come out of. They can't be separated.
Well, I think one of the important points that you were saying there is faith. And I think this is at the heart of it. People don't understand what faith is. Faith is a belief that a promise is going to be kept. It's a belief that someone is going to keep their word. That's what faith is. But the modern Jewish interpretation of faith is belief in something that doesn't exist, or belief in something that you don't know. You just don't know what it is. That's what faith is. Well, no, faith is a belief in a promise. It's a belief in God's promise. And this ties in with this idea that people can create their own religions. And that shows that the people that say that don't understand what religion is, and they don't understand what faith is. And they think that it could be replicated by man. And it can't be replicated by man. It comes from God. And the proof of that, as I said, it's in these prophecies which all come true. And this, the modern day paganism, the neo-paganism, this comes into this category because it's not a continuing tradition. It's not something that has continued on from the 5th century up until now. Our ancestors from the 5th century to the 10th century put away paganism and they evolved into Christianity, and the best bits of what they had learned from the philosophy of paganism was carried forward into Christianity. And that also includes Greek thought, Roman thought, Phoenician thought, and all the thought that went before that. And that got carried on into Christianity. And the remnants of our pagan beliefs were carried on into Christianity. I did a program at Christmas about how Odin is represented by Santa Claus. And I'm not joking about this. That's how our old beliefs became transmitted into the new ones. That's what they were relegated to. So the idea that 1,000 years later, people can just look at it and then say, oh, well, we'll follow this. And they imprint on it partially the things with Christianity, like with prayers and reverence. And that wasn't the way that these old gods were worshipped. It was a completely different way. What the pagan ideals were, it was a way of explaining the world to them and explaining psychology to them. Today we have science to explain the world to us, and we have psychology to explain the reasons why we have archetypes and the way that our thoughts work. It's an attempt to understand the spiritual world and how it interconnects with the world around us. Whereas the Christian religion is different to that. It's the creator God, and it's the laws that he expected us to keep as his creation. And obviously, if we are his creation, what he says for us is what is going to be best for us, which is why we will be, and because we're fallen, we'll be inclined to go against that, and we'll be inclined to follow, our older religions. I can understand that they're very tempting. But when you look at them, the characters that they have, the gods that they were actually worshipping, were flawed characters. Some of them would rape, some of them would cheat, some of them would lie. And these are all flawed aspects of the human personality, the fallen personality, whereas God is perfect, and the Christian God is perfect. So the pagan way of looking at things, if you want to call it pagan, the pagan belief system was very, very different to our concept of what a pagan religion would be today. And another aspect that people forget is that even though we had our different nations with our different national ideas of faith, all the kings still sent money to Jerusalem for the priests to offer sacrifices to the creator God. This is why Alexander the Great, he went straight there to the priests, the Romans as well. And all the kings of the known world sent money. That's how the temple was kept running, because they knew that the Israelites, the people that were there at Jerusalem, that were doing these sacrifices at the temple, that was to the creator God. The God of gods, as it were. And our gods, the king's gods, the national gods, they were ways of explaining the world around us. And when we look at Northern Europe as well, as particularly if you look at Gaul and you look at Britain, and you had the Druids and the Druidic beliefs, they never had any idols. They had a god of all, and it was a god in the past, the present, and the future. So it was a triune god. I mean, that may have had an influence on the Trinity in Christianity. But the Druids and their people in Northern Europe, they mocked the ideas of the Roman gods and worshipping Caesar as a god and worshipping these idols. They mocked that, and they were against that, and they saw the soul as eternal. And Julius Caesar wrote about them and said that this is why these British are so fearsome in battle, because they don't care if they die. They're willing to die because they know that their soul lives on. They have a belief in the eternal soul. And a lot of these ideas, they're very, very similar to the ideas that we find in Christianity. That's why there was a smooth process of moving from Druidry into Christianity in Britain and in Gaul. Later on, we see some issues with the Saxon gods, the Norse gods later on, but that was more political more than anything else. And the Saxons, when they came to England, Augustine came over, and within 100 years or so, they had become Christian. And then they were they were attacking the Welsh, who had been Christian already for 500 years by that time. And you've got all these issues that are political, but the main system, this spiritual system that they had, it wasn't like the church is today. It wasn't like our understanding of God today as God the creator. These were what they were looking at were sort of aspects of the human personality imprinted on with various kings and various noblemen. I mean, the closest that we would get to it today, I guess, would be honouring your ancestors, which is something you're supposed to do in Christianity. But we're not supposed to worship our ancestors. We're supposed to honour our ancestors. So this idea that we can resurrect paganism today, neo-paganism, and we can, you know, we can put our own imprints on it and try to create a new religion, it's no way is it a substitute for a proper religion and a proper connection with God and laws which cannot be changed. It's the fact that we had laws that cannot be changed because they came from God that our civilization was built upon. European civilization, Christendom, was built upon those laws. And it's been taken to an extreme today where those same laws are now being applied to foreigners. You know, the law of tolerance and tolerating difference of opinion, that works fine when it's just white people. But as soon as you allow foreigners the same leeway, which is what multiculturalism is, you end up with people at war with one another. When it's the same people, when it's white people who developed Christianity, then it works very well. And we end up with the free society that we have, and we end up with the freedom of speech that we should have. But as soon as you bring foreigners into it, it all falls apart. So a solution is not to go back to paganism. The solution is to go back to the root of our Christianity and look at that and work out what it was that caused our ancestors to see it as superior to paganism, because they clearly did. Otherwise, we wouldn't have it. You know, Europe wouldn't have become Christian if it wasn't superior. And this goes back to one of the pagan ideas, doesn't it? You know, might is right. Well, Christianity was mightier, so it was right.
Yeah, exactly. You can't have it both ways, where the Christians are evil and mean and horrible, and they impose their religion by imperial fiat and by force, and also maintain that might is right, because that means that we win. And if that's true, if that might is right, then that means that, you know, I guess the Jews are right, because they're successfully subverting all of these European nations, you know, through trickery. And that's a form of natural might, according to that kind of system of ethics, because they're producing the results. And so I think that I was reading a very interesting article the other day by a fellow by the name of David Bentley Hart, and it was called, I think, Nihilism and Christianity, or something to that effect, or Christianity and Nothing. And his argument was that, and it was fascinating, was that Christianity, one of the greatest proofs that Christianity was in fact the final religion, or this end stage religion, is that there have been no new religions that have arisen out of Christianized areas once they're totally Christianized. That doesn't really happen. And that there's been no challenger, there's been no naturally fluorescing, you know, pagan alternative to this religion since its advent. And it's Nietzsche, literally, I think he said something like this, you know, to the effect that, you know, there was alas for the fact that there was no new religion. And the reason for that is because Christianity is so all encompassing. It provides a total worldview, from the very highest levels of revelatory knowledge to the most practical everyday affairs of, you know, sacralizing the daily life. If you get into a stable enough Christian environment, with, you know, we can see with monastics, where everything that they do is a sacred ritual. And so this all encompassing, this totality, this absolutism, the ability for everything to be integrated into Christ, everything that's proper to human affairs to be integrated into the divine life of God, of the logos of order. This is the most powerful, and to people who reject Christ, the most oppressive faculty of Christianity, is that it provides this total worldview. And if you look at the history of dissension to, you know, Christianity, it's mostly been internal Christian schisms or philosophies and ideas which are kind of extremely heretical versions of Christianity, right? I mean, if we look at Islam and kind of Enlightenment, you know, philosophy, these are at best just extremely warped and distorted forms of Christian theology and philosophy, various flavors. And so this is the thing, is that there's been no new, you know, as Hitler would say, Mein Kampf, Weltanschauung, this worldview that can replace the Christian one. It just hasn't happened. And even now, everything is still reacting to the inertia of that worldview. It sets the standard in people's minds, well, whether or not they realize it. And, you know, and so that's the thing, is it goes back to, you know, this issue of ethics, where, I mean, you want good people to act ethically. You want them to act in a selfless manner, you know, with high social capital, and contribute towards, like, long lasting projects. Well, I mean, that's, you know, you have to give them a worldview which facilitates such integration. And if you look at the ancient world, we can see that we can see that the inheritors to the worldview which built the ancient world is the Christian civilization, without question. And this is very explicitly how the Romans, and later on the Germanics who converted to Christianity, saw themselves. I was listening to reading some history the other day. I can't remember exactly the citation, but he was an ancient Roman historian, and he was talking about how in the 4th and 5th centuries, when you had these masses of Germanic tribes flooding into the Western Roman Empire, you know, they were saying something to the effect of, you know, every Saxon wants to be a Roman. Only a poor Roman would want to be a Saxon. And of course, at this time, after Theodosius, 380 AD, baptism and citizenship in the Roman Empire were synonymous concepts.
Yeah, they were both together, and that's what people wanted to be. know, people wanted to be a part of the Roman civilization. I think, you know, one thing that can be added to this as well, you know, you don't have to throw away all the thought that we had before. I mean, for instance, the Vedas and the Aryan beliefs that we had, that way of looking at the world, that can still be used today. It's not incompatible with Christianity. If you look at something like the Kali Yuga, which you do your Kali Yuga news on Mysterium Fasces, and the Kali Yuga is the idea of looking at the Yugas is looking at stages of the world, different ages of the world, and it starts out perfect and it gradually gets worse and worse and worse until we get to today. And you find this reflected in the Bible with the age of gold going down to the age of iron, and eventually on this big statue, the iron is mixed with clay. It's the men of iron that are mixed with the men that are made of mud, which is our countries today. So we're right at the worst epoch that it is to live in. Man is corrupted and all the gods are corrupted as well. And I see it as Christianity is the only religion left in the last ages, in the last times, right at the worst time possible to live, with the most degeneracy and the most immorality. And that's why when we look at these ancient gods, they have flawed characters. As I say, they have moral failings, because this age is so corrupt that even the gods are corrupt. And the only one that is left is the creator of it all, the creator god, and the story of Christianity. And that's why it's so different to the rest of it as well. It's set apart from it, because you've got somebody that never did anything wrong, and it gave up his life and then was rewarded from that by conquering death, and we all have that to come at the end of it all. It seems to fit in with it to me. It's not you know, exclusive. Oh, if you follow Christianity, you have to ignore all of our history. You have to be against all of our history. No, it's absolutely fascinating to learn about it and to see it as the growth of the white race and what's taken part in that. It's like studying studying somebody's lifetime and everything that they did during their life. That's, you know, you study the white race and you see spiritually and religiously, and you see these various changes that happened and how it evolved into the situation where we're at today. And you can't say, well, we're going to go back to what we were doing, 1,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago anymore, that you can say, well, I'm going to go back to doing what I was doing when I was 5 or 6 years old, because we had a different view of the world back then. We were different people back then. We were not as morally corrupted as we are now. I mean, if you read the things that we were writing around 2,000 years ago, you would see that we were such upstanding people. We were really, really virtuous people. The idea of lying, putting a lie into print, it just wouldn't have entertained anybody to write something deliberately false to try and deceive people. We didn't have fiction for a start. I mean, everything today that's written down, we've got a massive growth in fiction. Well, they didn't have fiction back then. You know, why would somebody want to write about fiction? You know, you want to be recording what's going on for the later generations so that they can understand that. And today we want to be distracted from reality, so we fall into these traps of fiction and movies, and we are rebellious people, so we don't want to knuckle down and obey the law and obey God. You know, we would far rather look at these old pagan things and lust after that and wish that we were living in those times. But we're not. We're living in the times that we are now. And we are very lucky that we are here. If we think of the other white empires that went in the past, and they all got blended out, the Egyptians, the Indian, and all that's left is the European. And our religion is Christianity, and we are Christendom. The fact that some people in Africa or people in Asia might follow Christianity as well, that's got nothing to do with it. They also love our civilization. They want to do anything they can to copy us and have our civilization in their lands. Of course, they're going to be following our religion, but it doesn't detract from the fact that we brought it to the world, you know, and it came from Greek thought and also Hebrew thought, both countries right next to one another in the Mediterranean. It's the same people all along, and it reflects our ideas. It's a step backwards to go back into paganism, I think. And the idea that you can choose your own God. I mean, I've come across this as well when people say, oh, well, I follow this because I like the idea of it, or because this guy appeals to me, so I follow this. That's not the way it works. You know, if you are created by God, then he has chosen you. You don't choose him. You don't get any choice in the fact whether you belong to your creator or not. He created you. None of us created ourselves. We were all created by God. So the idea that you can pick what appeals to you, you're going to pick the wrong thing, because we have these, as you say, we have our fallen nature. You can look all the way back through history and you can see that everything is fallen. I mean, one thing I really like thinking about, and this is often a bit of a tangent, is looking at the symbol of the black sun, and what does that tell us? You know, that tells us that our material sun is a shadow of the black sun that we can't see. Everything that we see around us is flawed. We are fallen people. It's a fallen creation. The sun that we have up there is not the real sun. It ages us, and it helps. It can give us cancer. It's not what gives us life. The black sun is what gives us life, and everything that is around us is a shadow of what it should really be. The real life, the real earth, the real heavens, that is to come. We are living in a shadow world that is corrupted. It has death in it. It has disease in it. You know, all of those things tell us that something isn't right, that there's something more to life than what we see around us. And you find out what that is by studying Christianity. I never cease to be amazed by everything that black sun symbol can convey to us. And the fact that it is specifically a racial symbol, and it's a pro-white symbol, and it's only us nationalists that understand it and know what it is, you know, I find that is, you know, the chances of that happening by coincidence, you know, it wouldn't happen. You know what I mean? It's a symbol from God.
A big believer in coincidence. Before we go out here, I would just come back to these kind of pagan utilitarians. Well, the idea of choosing your own God. Well, what happens is that when you choose your own God, that you choose a God that's in your own image. This is the definition of an idol. Is it something that's created in the image of man, that he elects, that he decides the characteristics and the properties, and so on? It's a subsidiary creation. It's not the uncreated reality. This is the definition. And so what happens is that when you create an idol of your own ego, whether that's an explicit God or that's an ideology or that's whatever, some sort of worldview that you base your life around that's created, that's subsidiary, I mean, it's fallible. I mean, it's the first big thing, but it's not, it's fundamentally not true, because we know people's egos are relative, that their intellects are conditioned by their desires, by their passions, and that it corrupts the fruit of their spirit, because they were all corrupted. And so no man can produce on his own, by the light of natural reason, the totality of the truth. It has to be revealed unto him. This is fundamentally the claim of Christianity. And so, I mean, and this is the thing, is that as much as, we acknowledge the doctrines of God, the seed sower, that, you know, the seeds of the truth are sown in the traditions of all of these great civilizations, and that they all point towards the one eternal, ineffable truth. You know, the completeness of that is in direct revelation, essentially. And that's what makes the Christian religion so different, is that it doesn't possess these properties of being created, and that you can look at this revelation and you can verify the continuity of it.
Well, that's what proves the truth of it, doesn't it? You know, these things would only come from revelation, from somewhere else. You know, these prophecies that all came true in the Old Testament, and the prophecies in the New as well, the fulfillment of them. They just would not happen unless there was divine revelation. That's what proves the truth of it, isn't
Here's
it?
Here's a really, really quick one before we leave. I mean, people might not be familiar with this, but in the book of Isaiah, which is dated to at least 200 BC by very liberal scholars, probably hundreds of years before that, Isaiah predicts that all of the nations, all of the Gentiles would worship the God of Israel, that all of the kings of the earth would bow down before the God of Israel. That's happened.
There's even more than that. There's predictions of Titus, Vespasian.
Over and over again, right? But that's just on the surface, is that not even liberal the scholars will dispute that this is true. And I mean, if you read the scholarly works around it, it gets so insane. They're just like, miracles aren't real. So how can this possibly be true? How can we date it this late or this early, rather?
Specific incidents, isn't there? Are you specific people, specific times, specific things happening that are all predicted? And there's no way it could have come from anything else other than divine revelation. You know, it is the truth. But where we are fallen, we don't want to, face up to the truth. This is the thing, that the truth hurts. So we don't want to face up to it. We try and make laws, hate crime laws, because we don't want to face up to the truth. People don't want to face up to the truth. And most of Christianity today doesn't want to face up to the truth, Judeo-Christianity. But there's still a few of us that do hold to the truth and do uphold God's law, and we will continue to do so. Florian, thank you very much for coming on today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back on Monday. I hope you all have a great weekend. God bless and hail victory. Oh.